Ego. When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. John Muir. My friend Lauren co-founded a nonprofit called Kind Campaign. She travels to schools around the country and speaks with young girls about bullying, unhealthy friendships, and identity. She looks younger than she is stylish, and she is beautiful. This piques the girl's attention, that she is some strange creature who is adult and cool, yet young and definitely not a teacher. At these talks, Lauren shares her story of being bullied in seventh grade and how it spiraled her into a severe depression and suicidal state. She teaches the girls that sometimes it's hard to see outside their school hallways. How, even though it feels like school is their entire world, it's important to realize it's one chapter of their story. That there's beauty, friendship, adventure, and so much life lying ahead of them. And to know that when they are struggling with things that feel big and scary, they can reach out for help. That no one has to suffer alone. She once told me a story of a high schooler who was kicked out of her friend group and forced to get something like 100 likes on each Instagram post and some ghastly number of new followers each day before she could sit with the other girls at lunch. This girl was so distraught, she told Lauren that she spent all her free time after school making fake accounts so that she could like her own posts and follow herself. "I have to do it," she said. "I'm miserable, but I have no choice." Lauren hears endless stories like this, stories of brokenness, of girls confused and lost and trapped and scared. Recently, a 12-year-old came up to Lauren after the assembly. The girl was tiny, holding her hands down in front of her, making herself as small as possible as she gathered the strength to speak. "Can I ask you a question?" she mumbled. Lauren leaned down. "I'm sorry, what, my darling? Can I ask you a question?" "Of course," Lauren said, now squatting to make herself smaller than the girl. "Is it okay if I don't know who I am?" Lauren gave her a look of understanding. Her heart broke at the baldness of the girl's honesty. She gave herself a second to think of an answer. "It's perfectly fine to feel like you don't know yourself," she said finally. "One of the most beautiful parts of life is getting to know yourself over time, and that can change during different chapters of your life, too. I'm still getting to know myself." "You are?" the young girl said. "Yes, I am. I know a lot about myself at this age. I like myself, but there is so much more to know. You are on a wonderful journey. You're exactly where you should be." "Okay, are you sure?" "Yes, I'm sure." The girl gave Lauren a half smile and stiffly hugged her. "Okay, thank you," she said matter-of-factly. "What if I don't know who I am?" There are layers in that girl's question. So much of life is lived in magnetic attraction to undefined concepts. Love, meaning, fulfillment. We all want to be somebody. But what is a somebody? When I look back at my nervous journal entries, old photos, and confessions from high school and college, I see a through line. Every time I've been in a state of flux, of change, I fear that I will be trapped there. Will this confusion last forever, I wonder. But it never does, and I haven't grown weary yet in this business of uncovering, unmasking, and constructing who I am. It is both discovery and intention, and it is endless, and it's okay. Yes, I'm sure. Who you are is the braided marriage of circumstance, ego, and soul in that order. First, you have circumstance, the what of your life. Where you were born, your sex and gender, your parents and your hair and your skin and bones. The ego knits this all together into a whole, a concept. It is what most of us would consider who we are, the container in which you build an identity and then defend it. The ego acts as your agent, manager, and lawyer, all while believing it is the thing itself. Its worst fear is to be belittled or unnoticed. It takes everything personally. Your body walks into a party where you don't know anyone. You feel anxious. That you is your ego. But another part of you is watching you get anxious. Something separate, but still you, is observing your ego. Some higher part of you that says, "Why do I feel like this? Everyone seems so nice." This is your soul. We've all done something mad or wild and said, "Who am I right now?" This is the division between the ego and the soul. The ego's desires are based on the body, on scarcity and fear and lust and hunger. The soul's desires are based on, well, what does the soul want? Completion? Balance? Understanding? Acceptance? It's hard to know. How strange is it that we're all walking around with this crowd in our head, our body, our ego, which is the mind of the body, and our soul, which is the watcher, the cosmic something else. Maybe it's nothing but a side effect of consciousness, but I am writing this right now, and I am also watching myself write it. Some part of me is above it, eternal, and cannot be hurt by failure or disgrace. What a nice part of me to seek out and cultivate. We are three things: the car, the driver, and the awareness of it all. I remember kissing a boy and experiencing all three parts. The sensation of touch and his weight on me, of hands flying everywhere. I remember my ego paying close attention to how I was coming across. Is my kiss right? Too much tongue? Not enough, maybe. Is my hand okay here? Or does it seem like I'm swimming? Oh God. Okay, now every time I do something with my tongue, he does the exact same thing. Is he copying me? Maybe he's nervous too. And then the soul awareness coming from above. Look at yourself. Aren't you funny? Flailing on someone else as they flail on you. This is adorable. You're doing great, sweetie. I think most people live the majority of their lives in ego, defined by what they're doing, what they're thinking, how they organize and categorize the world. I do what makes me comfortable and avoid what makes me insecure. That pretty much sums up my life. I don't like team sports. I have tragic hand-eye coordination and end up costing my team games. They laugh and say, "We're just out here having fun, doesn't matter." But I watch their eyes flare up in those moments of competitive adrenaline. They want to win. They love the animal thrill of victory, and I'm holding them back. So I avoid them. I tell them I don't like getting dirty or that I have work to do. Inside, it brings up the shame I felt when I was soft and slow as a child. My ego chimes in. "This will embarrass you. Instead of trying, tell your friends sports are dumb. Call them trite and meaningless. Focus on other sources of esteem." This is also why I don't like going to clubs, the kind where single people go to look cute and dance. It's very looky-loo and sexy, and I don't fit in. I'm not an Adonis, and I don't have good hair. Some of my friends love going, dancing, getting hit on by strangers. It's a lighthearted thrill for them. They know I hate it, though, so they complain about it to make me feel included. Ugh. Another guy wouldn't leave me alone. I was like, "Dude, I'm here with my friends." And I'll play along. People are so desperate. I'm like, "Chill, let us live." Of course, no one is ever hitting on me. But if I act annoyed too, I can gather scraps of superiority. I do like parties, though. I am good at talking, and people like my jokes. I meet new people, and they laugh loudly and ask me where I've been hiding all these years. Some of my friends don't like these parties. They feel clumsy and insecure when talking to new people. A party of strangers is exhausting for them. I'll walk away from a cackling stranger and complain to my friend standing alone, "This random person thinks I'm going to save their number in my phone and hang out." That's cute. I say this to make my friend feel special. They laugh with me. "People are clueless," they say. I wonder how much of who we are comes down to doing what we know we're good at and avoiding what makes us feel small. How far can we peel back the onion before our personalities are just equations and chemical reactions? Perhaps if we really knew what made us feel small, we would see that it had no business running our life. Interviewer: What do you dislike most about your appearance? Zadie Smith: I like it all. Self-hatred is for younger, prettier women. Vanity Fair: I'm glad I'm not too young or too pretty. When I was young, I was an awkward blob. I had acne all over my face, to the point where I couldn't rest my forehead on the desk at school without pain. This is something I often wanted to do, put my head down and shut out the world. I ate barbecue chips and Rocky Road ice cream and drank a six-pack of Dr. Pepper every day. Every day. By ninth grade, I weighed 190 pounds at 5'8". And not in a cute teddy bear kind of way. I looked like I was inflated haphazardly, with a thin face and huge hips. It was almost like life decided to protect me from vanity during the years when my mind and identity were forming. I don't like extremes. They're a lonely, mutating force when entangled with the ego. Too pretty, and you'll feel like a product. Everyone will want you, which you'll love at first because youth wants attention and hormones want touch. But as you form into a whole person, you'll begin to wonder if your ideas and heart are as valuable as your face and body. The same goes for other traits. Too clever, and you'll wield your words to control other people and feed your baser needs. You'll run the room and run your own head and let yourself off too easy when you're due a proper rebuke. Too rich, and your friends will feel inadequate. Too silly, and you'll become a jester, a caricature. You won't trust your own sadness or awe. Too serious, and you'll wrinkle and rust, unable to find the comedy in death and injustice. You'll have no stamina for the fight. I want to be balanced, like a year in Tennessee, a good winter that never gets too cold, a hot summer that drives me to the water, a neon green spring, and a crisp fall. I want to like how I look, but not too much. Catch myself in the mirror and say, "Hey, not too bad. I like your hat." Few things are trickier for the ego than good looks, money, and fame. One of our basest desires is to belong, and these gifts, in abundance, complicate the search. If you have one or a few of these things, you probably know what I'm talking about. Someone approaches you for your beauty or wealth, and you recognize their motive straight away. Or worse, miss the motive until it's too late. Some people envy you, and if you struggle, you do not receive sympathy, because our culture has convinced us that people with these things should not have problems. I have an acquaintance who is a billionaire, one of those tech guys who made ghastly amounts of money in his 20s on servers, computer storage, or something like that. He's my age, that is, still pretty young, with a lovely wife and a beautiful, healthy child. And yet the money has deformed him. He is as insecure as his bank account is large. A few years ago, he was getting eviscerated in the press for a lavish birthday party he'd thrown. The comment section of one article was a bloodbath. People called him tone-deaf and disgusting and opulent. He was devastated. He had been a nerd his whole life, and his brilliance and hard work and luck had made him one of the richest people on the planet. Before he was rich, his friends had admired him for his mind. Now he was being mocked. I'll never forget him saying, "No one feels sorry for a billionaire." That one sentence had so much in it. Deep down, we believe money must solve our problems. As if we all think, "If I had that money, I'd be set. All my shitty problems would be gone. Why should that idiot have it?" Since that party, the billionaire has dedicated hundreds of millions of dollars to an environmental charitable foundation that bears his name. He wants to solve the climate crisis. He wants to be remembered well. Perhaps one day his foundation will invent the clean energy source that saves this planet. All because an insecure kid was made fun of, and he tried to buy the love of the world by saving it. We think we know what we want, but we're fooling ourselves. We do not understand the true nature of things. I got B's in high school and a handful of A's. I was lazy as hell, smart enough to do the bare minimum, and friendly enough with the teachers to get graded on a curve. I always used to say, if I tried, I could get all A's. In truth, I was afraid of failure, of trying harder and ending up with the same grade, and knowing without a doubt that I couldn't do it. It was so much safer believing in the maybe than knowing the no. That's one of the reasons I didn't like sports. I didn't like how it quantified things. The runner in the next lane is faster than you, by a lot. The numbers don't lie. Being a silly weirdo wasn't like that. No one sat around with a whistle, grading jokes and declaring winners of wit. To this day, I fear quantification. I would hate to know my IQ. Zelda Fitzgerald said it like this. I hope I'll never get ambitious enough to try anything. It's so much nicer to be damned sure I could do it better than other people. As you get older, though, you look around the world and see that avoidance doesn't do much. Sure, it keeps you from a little embarrassment here and there. But all the people I look up to, the artists and the athletes, the chefs and the CEOs, they risked embarrassment. There was a moment when each of them stepped toward the fright. They applied for the job, even if they knew it was a stretch. They told people of their coming glory. They asked the boy out. They sat down and wrote the book. I keep learning these lessons, however reluctantly, however embarrassingly. Each day, I peel away a piece of armor that I built in eighth grade. I must have put a lot on. When I was a kid, someone asked me why I talked like a girl. I hated my voice for the next decade. Later, when I was a teenager, a random kid walked up to me at school and asked why my acne was so bad. I said I didn't know why. You need a dermatologist, he said. Okay, I replied, with the awkwardness of 1,000 puberties. But I never followed his advice. Seeing a doctor would have forced me to admit it was real. I had wished so badly to be invisible. I convinced myself that people couldn't see my face, but they could. There are moments, especially in those early years, that become the structural support beams for our lives. We aren't born into a self. It is created without our consent. We build ourselves on top of comments, offhanded insults, inadequacies. By the time we wake up to ourselves, we are a Jenga stack of experiences that we spend the rest of our lives deconstructing. Sometimes I wonder what happened to God when he was young, to make him jealous enough to give us death. Perhaps it was the apple, the rejection. Maybe he was hurt. This is happening to the young people in your life right now. Your kids, your nephews and nieces, your little siblings. We should be careful with the young people in our lives. Say kind things, aspirational things. But also, go back and talk to yourself. Unpack those moments. The thing someone said in eighth grade that shook you forever, they probably didn't mean it. Maybe they don't even remember it. Every time I've had the thrill of epiphany, it always comes as a new way of seeing what was already there. The knot in my stomach untangles. The experiences of life, which fell on me like chaos, reveal themselves to be lumber, building materials for the life I was made to live. I think we can forgive ourselves. We can forgive our parents. We can forgive God. We can say thank you for pain, because on top of it rests other blocks of companionship, of triumph and joy. We can say thank you because we don't really understand anything, and yet here we are. We wake up atop the dirt of our childhoods with a shovel in our hands. In our pockets is a crumpled note with conspicuously familiar handwriting. It says, "Good luck." I've been thinking about the hundreds of traits that affect how we move through the world. Beauty, ethnicity, charisma, family, economic privilege, zip code, physical abilities. You know those huge mixing boards in recording studios with sliders and knobs that turn this sound up, that one down, to find the perfect mix? That's how I see all of us. I think of my own mix, a gay, white Christian boy from Tennessee, a kid with a soft body and acne. Teenage hotness? That knob is turned down. But a nice smile? Tick up the hotness just a little. Throw in a quick mind that adjusted to rejection by learning how to be funny, and a natural optimism that colors my humor playful instead of cold and cutting. A feminine voice? I had it, but got mocked for it, so I turned that knob down myself. I grew up with divorced parents and a family constantly in flux. Stability? Middle position. Adaptability? Turned up. But my parents loved me unconditionally and supported me in absolutely every way. Self-worth turned up. The traits play off one another and become something greater than their sum. Beauty is nice, but if you lack social skills, are depressed, or have been abused, life can still be hell. Or perhaps you could have a lot of societal dials turned against you. Female, poor, black in the Deep South, a survivor of rape, for example, Oprah. But have your discernment, intuition, charisma, smarts, ambition, and mastery of language turned all the way up. In an individualistic society like the United States, those qualities are practically religious virtues. Add to that our love for rags-to-riches stories, and that poor girl grows up to become a god. A gay man like me, who is able to hide by changing his voice and body language pretty early on, is different from another who couldn't do that. We are both gay and therefore share internal scripts that others don't, but there is not a perfect overlap. This is true for any person who finds themselves part of a group. They fit with their peers in one way, but the unique position of various sliders in their life prevents perfect matching. In every category you're put in, you can feel tremendous solidarity and isolating uniqueness at the very same time. I surprise myself all the time. I'll be in a mood and want to go home without knowing why. I'll drive home dreaming of a restful afternoon, but when I get there, I'll feel restless and hollow, somehow both tired and anxious to be doing something else. The same thing happens in my relationships. I'll adore someone, and then for no reason start finding them frustrating. Something in me is watching that and saying, "Jed, why are you being a little bitch? Quit that." But I can't. Which voice is the real me, the watcher or the actor? Sometime last year, I was walking down the street with my friend Jordan, whistling. I said, "Jordan, think about whistling. I have no idea how my lips are making these tiny movements to hit the exact next note of the Mario theme song. The movement is so tiny I can't even imagine it, and yet my lip muscles know what to do." We spent the rest of the walk making observations like this. "I have no idea how I'm walking right now. I don't know how my legs are moving, they just are." We laughed at our ignorance, at the marvel of being alive and able to move and do things. I feel my best when I forget myself, my body, my existence, when my self-conscious drive to name and label falls asleep. I am just a weed in the field, loving the breeze and eating the sun. I don't know what I am. I've had people see me driving alone. Maybe they'd stopped in town at a red light and noticed me in the car next to them and say, "Jed, you looked so sad. What was wrong?" I wasn't sad. I was just alone in my car and thinking, or maybe not thinking, just driving and being simple. Should I be grinning to myself in the car? No. Those encounters made me realize how communicative our faces are, how we expect that they be on whenever we're around people. Alone and in a neutral state, our faces take a stillness that would be interpreted as sadness or anger in the company of another. Makes me wonder how much personality is put on, how different we'd act if alone too long. You know when it's dark outside and the lights are on in a house across the street? You can see in the kitchen, and the mom is there and she's doing dishes or something. Or maybe it's not the mom. It could be the mistress, or the mom is away on a work trip. Maybe it's a roommate. How can I know? But I do this all the time. I'll notice a neighbor doing things in the window and make up an entire story about who they are. Somehow, the more people crammed together in a place, the easier it is to be alone, to not know who's across the way living their life. I'm never more alone than when I'm on an airplane, touching knees with a stranger, headphones on. You may meet me and then think that you know me. I am an open book, so your guesses will often be right. But the lights are on at night, and your guesses are only guesses. There are rooms inside of me that don't face the street. There are kids playing in the basement. There are cars in the driveway. At best, we're all guessing. I once asked a friend, as a kind of test, when you meet someone new, do you automatically trust them until they prove they shouldn't be trusted? Or do you treat everyone as suspect and make them prove that they are worthy? He said, I assume they're annoying and terrible, and they have to prove to me that I'm wrong. I laughed. I'm the opposite. I assume they're great and a future friend. They have to prove to me that they're terrible. This is why you suffer so many fools, he said. Or why I have so many friends. What do you see in the window? What do you assume? In 10 years, none of this is going to matter. Older people would tell me that in high school, when I was all torn up about a friendship. They would say it when I was stressed beyond belief in college, embroiled in roommate drama, or writhing in unrequited love. People in their 30s, fresh out of the madness of adolescence, love to say things like that. To pat the youngsters on the head and say, I remember when I was all hormones and no chill, it'll pass. Often, these 30-somethings are saying it to themselves more than anyone else. They're congratulating themselves for surviving. But to the high schooler, the college sophomore, it matters now. It is life or death. And really, it does matter. The drama is testing our social skills, teaching us to read the signals of jealousy, hurt, sarcasm, and betrayal. Our fights and crushes and gossip are the emotional muscles flexing, in the same way a baby flails her arms and legs in the crib to see how far they stretch. To build those baby muscles, soon enough to stand. We feel too much in those years. We jam our hearts into every glass slipper. We can't become wise without living first. We can't know peace without chaos first. We can't know belonging until we've hedged our bets on the wrong clan and felt alone in a crowded room. It won't matter in 10 years. Is untrue. It all matters. It just won't feel like it feels now. For some, it'll transform from panic into gratitude, from scarcity into strength. But this doesn't happen for everyone. Some people build themselves on their pain. It defines them. Perhaps the pain is so big that it should. But for most of us, the felt transgressions of growing older and bumping into other people are an invitation to growth. It matters how we frame it. So much mental energy is spent maintaining self-worth. When an artist makes something, and God forbid it is a success, a new horror is born. Will I ever make something this good again? Will anyone care? Was it an accident? The fear always returns to you. To your idea of yourself, to how you think you're coming across, and the mysterious made-up projection of how you think others think of you. I glance at the mirror and think I look pretty good. Then I see a photo of myself and I look like a bridge troll. Same day, same clothes. Somehow the mirror allows me to shapeshift in my imagination, to trick myself or something. But the picture says otherwise. Maybe because it's static, and in the mirror I can wiggle until I like an angle. I'll see the photo and say, "Do I really look like that?" And my friend will say, "Yes, you look great. What are you talking about?" I've seen people modify photos of their faces so severely that they look like a different person online, smoothed out, cartoonish, and plastic. Surely they're making a joke, I think, but they are not. And I wonder what their blindness to their own face means, and what blind spots I have. I know some of the stories I've made up to maintain my self-worth. As a kid, I highlighted my weirdness and uniqueness to remove myself from competition. I memorized Stanley Kubrick movies, I watched anime, I wrote poems and bought movie soundtracks. I was obsessed with film composers like John Williams and Danny Elfman. This differentiated me from the jocks who loved the Red Hot Chili Peppers and watching baseball. I built my identity on untouchable things. This way of being followed me into adulthood. I don't feel jealous of anyone. I don't compare myself to anyone. I like myself. My sense of identity is built in culture and cleverness, in taste, in making a well-timed reference. But I also see how this part of me was built in the insecure halls of middle school. My insecurities and my responses to them shaped who I am today, a person I seem to like. A person who feels superior to those washed-up jocks with torn ACLs and beer bellies. Sing the body. Sing the body. What have I not hated about my own? I remember joking in high school that I would never procreate to protect the species from my ugliness. I remember thinking my hands were handsome and my teeth were straight. Measly concessions for a body meant for the basement. But oh, sing your 30s, when I stopped wishing I was someone else. 2 decades of that had scalded me, and something switched. The mirror stopped its hissing, its condescending remarks. I stopped hating my skeleton, my skin, the way my body did what it needs to do. This is my body, and it is good. And sometimes, in romantic moments, I let people love it, and they do love it. No matter how the buried teenage boy in me tries to warn them, "You are being tricked. This is ugliness." No, it is not. It is the body of a man, and he carries it as a man. How you sing the body is what your lover hears. Sing to yourself. I've heard the song of the 40s is even sweeter. My friend Tom, a filmmaker, professor, and writer, told me, "Whatever your pain is, that's where you're going to find your passion." Whenever I talk to students, I ask them, "Where do you hurt specifically?" For example, the school system always pushed me out. It didn't accept the creative person that I was, and nobody listened to me. So my passion now is listening to kids and accessing the voice in them that has been quieted and silenced. That came from my pain. Look at how people give back, how they choose to help the world. The rich donate to causes or start foundations. The middle class give what they can or spend time volunteering. Notice how they choose to put purpose in their life, how it almost always has a personal cause. They had a daughter with cystic fibrosis. They donate to research to cure it. They suffered police abuse and now rally in the streets for justice. The thing that injured you often becomes a piece of your purpose in life. There are 2 privileges. The privilege of worldly access, the world being made for you, of wealth and whiteness and a runway of ease. And its opposite, the privilege of spiritual access, the world not being made for you, the forced awakening of the inner eye, the hard hand and invitation to see the world clearly. The first is a privilege that blesses you early and hurts you late. In the end, it robs you of the invitation to wisdom and harmony. The other hurts you early and blesses you in time. My friend Taekwon told me stories of how he got picked on in high school, being called a faggot for his voice and mannerisms. He ran away from home and went wild to get away from it. Sex and drugs and all the staples of rebellion. He burned bright and hot. Then, at 24, he had his great awakening and quit it all. In some ways, you're lucky, I said. You were forced to face your real identity early. You had to test it and find it fast because the world wasn't made for you. That's why you're so whole now and still so young. Well, I do love who I am, he said. But damn, it was a journey. But yeah, I guess I'm glad I'm not coming out only now with a kid and a wife or a broken up heart and all confused as fuck. Sometimes the hurt from your youth is the horrible hand of God, refining you toward wisdom and purpose. What stands in the way becomes the way. Marcus Aurelius. As a kid, I was terrified of being called gay. I didn't want to be different. I didn't want to be described as my gay friend Jed, but rather my friend Jed. Being labeled is claustrophobic. It locks you into connotations, and so I hid. I tried to change my voice, talk less with my hands, be funnier, sharp and clever. My first goal was to belong. And because I looked like all my friends, all I had to do was change my behavior. I think about this a lot when I consider the lives of people of color in a white majority. Where I could disappear behind behavior in a straight majority, they cannot. The skin cannot hide. Have you ever been dragged to a party where you didn't know anyone? You sit on the couch and feel the thickness in the air. Do I belong? Do they wish I hadn't come? It's not that people are outright mean to you. Maybe even the host comes to say hi. But in the middle of that conversation, you get a look from someone across the room that says, "Who is that guy?" You feel the eyes. It's not just the outright bigotry. It's also the cool girl with the big house throwing a party. She would never say, "No black people, no gays." That would feel mean and set off the alarms of conscience. It's more, "Do I know you? Do we have things in common?" The unseen biases. The selective attraction to the similar, which is much more common than conscious rejection. That is just it. I feared being rejected, so I tried to morph into the majority. I lowered my voice. I sharpened my sense of humor so that I could deflect a comment or win the crowd. If you are different, and most teenagers feel different in one way or many, you contort yourself to fit in. And it takes years of untangling your limbs to become wholly you. Now I carry my otherness with swagger. What was once a cancerous growth on my identity is now a badge, a prize. I see this in so many communities of otherness. They start in the shadow of loneliness, of rejection, and find one another. And band together and begin to radiate a light of their own making. But what is the cost? I wonder what a lifetime of feeling other would do to me, if my tricks of behavior hadn't made me friends, if my sexuality had led to true rejection. I wonder what a million cuts of bias do to our friends. I bet I would be angry. A hum of rage behind my eyes. I think growing up other gave me thick skin, and I think we should all have thick skin. But a tender touch now and then can bring me to tears. I can't get this out of my head. When I bullshit someone, they don't care. I'm bullshitting myself. The lie lives on in me. When I pretend to be less or more than my full identity, I present a character to the world. one I must maintain and prune and reinvent and defend. I poison my authenticity by the acrobatics of personal propaganda, propping up the idiot dictator of my ego, spending my time imagining what other people are thinking instead of thinking for myself. The parts of me I hide are an implicit judgment. This part of me is bad. This part is not good enough. I am ashamed. And shame is a flesh-eating disease. I want coherence. I want the through line to be visible. I don't want anyone to dig up a part of me and play gotcha. What a tense way to live. A guy I went on a few dates with once texted me, "I sold my Coachella tickets." "Why? I thought you were so excited," I wrote. We had connected over loving music festivals. "I got a pimple," he said. "LOL," I wrote back. "For real, did you sell them? Why?" "I told you. I got a zit on my chin. I don't look cute. I'm not going." I cannot tell you how flabbergasted I was. What in the world? How can someone care about their appearance that much? After a vicious cycle of mocking this person in my head, I received a tender thought. Everyone just wants to bring something to the table. The vain person, refining the angle of their face for the camera, staying home because of a zit. They fear that if their look is off, people will say, "Why are they here?" The comedian, speaking louder now to make sure the joke lands, making fun of the vain person, mocking everything in a frenzy. He fears that if he doesn't get laughs, people will say, "Why is he here?" The relationship wizard, asking about boys and girls you have kissed, talking about hearts and entanglement. They fear that if they don't have their finger on the gossip, on the up-to-date who and where, people will ask, "Why are they here?" I wonder if we'd feel insecure on a desert island. I know I wouldn't worry about my hair, my jokes. I wouldn't care to keep up with the news. I wouldn't have to compile my cleverness for the dinner table tonight. Would the feeling of contentment last? I would probably play with a hermit crab for the afternoon and tell him how lovely his claws were. Pretty soon, I'd hope he liked me, approved of me, crawled to me tomorrow. My friend's newborn was crying. She picked up her baby. "What's wrong, my love? Are you hungry?" Nope, she wasn't hungry. "Maybe your diaper's ready for changing." "Oh, there it is." She changed the diaper, and just like that, the baby stopped crying. She said, "My doula helped me reframe it all. She said, your baby isn't crying, she's talking. She just doesn't know any words yet. So she's doing the best she can to communicate." She's not crying, she's talking. Babies cry because they can't speak. They don't know how to ask for what they need. They might not even know what they need, so they wail. The nag of a mystery craving is madness. When adults can't speak to their discontent, when they can't quite figure out what it is they're wanting, they will try anything. They drink or commit adultery or quit their jobs or run away or live vicariously through their kids or stonewall their husbands. They knock things off the counter just to feel some control. They burn down their own house to escape it without really knowing where else to go. This is the tragedy of being an animal with a mind. We are punching the walls to stop the ache in our chest. The other day, a friend of mine drank too much and said some nasty things, dark and hateful. Not about me, but about another friend. And I was shocked. I thought he liked this person. Actually, he'd said lovely things about them at dinner earlier that night. But now he was going on and on about how they are shit and talentless and cheap. I was sober enough to protest and to know that my friend wouldn't remember saying this the next day. But it sent me into a spin as I went to bed. I've always agreed with the saying, "I don't trust anyone who doesn't drink because I don't know who they really are." people show more of their inside minds when loosened by alcohol. But with this friend, I was frightened to think that his outburst was the real him, that deep down he was hateful and bitter, and the surface was a mask. I got some good advice about this when I brought it up with another friend. They told me, "We're all insecure and dealing with a lot of layers. Maybe a few drinks take away his inhibition, and you see into who he is, but too drunk is another story. Don't worry about it. Your friend probably suffers from some insecurities about taste and career. Him getting nasty doesn't mean he is a nasty person. We all have that in us. He should just be careful when he drinks." When I was a kid watching the Golden Globes, one of the celebrities on the red carpet said, "I just ran into Brad Pitt at the urinal. He was standing next to me, peeing." I thought, whoa, Brad Pitt goes to the bathroom? Who knew? Why would that be a surprise? No one has ever told me that the rich and famous don't use the bathroom. I came up with that on my own. Why? Perhaps Barack Obama gets toe cramps and dribbles a little extra after he pees. George Clooney has gone to the toilet and realized, too late, that there's no toilet paper. Meryl Streep has taken off her shoes on the couch and realized her feet smell like death and that her friends must smell them too. It must have something to do with our delusion that money and fame remove the embarrassments of being human. They must solve our basic problems. When I was little, I wanted to write a fan letter to a Disney animator who had worked on Aladdin. His name was Eric Goldberg, my hero. My mom said, "I'll find his address." I protested, "Mom, I can't just write him. He's famous." "Jed, everyone is a human being," she said. "Everyone, and they all love to be encouraged." So I wrote Eric Goldberg a letter, and my mom sat on the phone like a private eye, tracking down his address. A month later, he wrote back. He drew me an original drawing of the genie that said, "Yo, Jed, I ain't never had a friend like you." I was 10 years old. From that moment, I have always believed I could talk to anyone. People are people, no more, no less. And they all love to be encouraged. My friend's uncle once told me, "I wouldn't have any idea how old I was if I didn't own a mirror. I'm 55, but I still feel 25. I quit looking at mirrors last year." That was years ago, but I still think about it. We are so aware of what we look like. Without mirrors and photography, I wouldn't really know how my face appears to other people. I guess a calm puddle would give me a clue, but those aren't terribly common in Southern California. For 95% of our species' history, we only had puddles. How many times have I had a fun time dancing at a birthday party? Then, when someone shows me a video from that night, I see my ugly-ass dance moves for what they are. Immediately, I am horrified, worried what people were really thinking about me. The freedom and joy I felt then is erased by the shame I feel now. I wish I'd never seen myself. Precarious manhood, a better term for toxic masculinity, might be the most destructive force in society. The tender boy falls prey to the teenage years, when the world tells him to lock away his emotions and treat sincerity as a joke. In high school, I can't tell you how many times a moment of male encouragement or kindness degenerated into no-homo jokes or hyper-homo mockery. Human beings are a cocktail of masculinity and femininity. To believe that we are meant to emulate one pole at the expense of the other, and that our sex alone should tether us to a caricatured extreme, is scientifically false and destructive. We all know masculine women and feminine men. 1 out of 1,000 people are born intersex. We are alchemy, not static elements. And when we fight the truth to imitate a cartoon, of course we suffer. These boys suppress their complexity and hurt and affection, and coil up into dangerous springs of misplaced energy. They become presidents, CEOs, husbands. They wage wars and punch their spouses. Their companies destroy nature because a multi-factored codependent ecosystem is something incomprehensible to them. Because the balance of femininity is denied them, total compartmentalization is the norm, looking at the world one way and blocking out the effects of all the others. The word masculinity almost has a dirty connotation to me. In childhood, it was a word used as a weapon against sissy boys and artists. It came to mean most of the things I dislike in men: blind strength, bullying, boasting, hierarchy built on things I didn't possess. Until men understand their own hearts, until we make room for the bigness of one another, we will continue to suffer. I don't know if it's a masculine trait or a trait expressed by all humans equally, but some men have a unique ability to walk away from personal failure. At least this is what I've seen in some of the men around me. It must be related to compartmentalization. They can wake up in the trash heap of their own life, in a room turned upside down, with the drapes on fire, and become as calm as a surgeon. They walk out the front door and never look back. I've seen fathers, boyfriends, friends get so tangled in their mistakes and shame that their only recourse seems to be a total reset. Their pride becomes a dead-eyed shark. The hard work of analyzing their life, of parsing out what went wrong and setting out to fix it, is too great, too close to damning their idea of who they are. To fix a deformed leg, sometimes you must first break the bone and set it right. They won't have it. It is better to limp away. And they do it without a wince on their face. I met a man in Baja, California, who left his life in Texas to start fresh. He said he'd had a family, but it, quote, got complicated, so he left. Now in his 60s, he lives on the beach in a camper van. When I spent 2 summers in Alaska as a teenager, I remember seeing the same thing. There were so many grizzled men with wrinkles acquired from wrongdoing. They came to Alaska to forget and to be forgotten. The state seemed full of them. Patagonia is like that too. The ends of the earth. The places that do not ask follow-up questions. I know I have it in me. In a small, frightening way, I have felt it when I've failed and my soul hardens like a statue. I've felt a surge of shame flip some switch and turn me cold, meticulous, surgical. I won't live like that. It takes a safe and wide love to teach a man that it's possible to fail and remain. When our culture finds a healthy understanding of masculinity and femininity, and how these two energies coexist in all of us, we will see big changes in mental health. Men won't silence their tenderness for fear of emasculation. Women won't squash their power for fear of being effeminated. Effeminization isn't a word, but how interesting that there isn't an equivalent of emasculation in the feminine. As if the masculine is so vulnerable to corruption that it needed a special word. In middle school, I remember seeing drag queens in high heels and thinking, they are so annoying, I'm not gay like them. What I had done was internalize homophobia as a survival mechanism. If I made fun of those gays, maybe I would be more masculine and therefore safer in my straight world. And indeed, I was rewarded for it. I had straight friends who would introduce me by saying, he's gay, but not that gay. In my mid-30s, I'm still unpacking the big-ass suitcase of fears and insecurities and blind spots that I discovered in my adulthood. So I am leaning into living it. I don't judge my voice anymore. I don't wonder if I'm speaking with my hands too much. I don't worry that someone can tell I'm gay. I don't say disparaging things about any form of gender manifestation. I want to embody freedom so that others might be free. I want to be a true man, both feminine and masculine, to let my adolescent self know that not only is it okay, it is the only truth there is. Whenever someone is freaking out over nothing, when their world has come undone because she won't text back, or the airline lost their luggage, or they got another parking ticket, I want to point to the sky and say, we're floating on a boulder in space, spinning at an incredible speed, held down by gravity and some arbitrary rule of physics. There's only so much organic material on this planet, which means we're made of molecules that came from dead stars. Dead stars. Some part of you was probably part of a dinosaur. For you to exist, every single one of your ancestors had to survive long enough to procreate, all the way back to the Stone Age, and monkeys, and small mammals, and reptiles, and fish, and cells. You exist thanks to an unbroken chain of successful sex. Everything is a miracle, so calm your ass down. I'm tempted to say all of that, but I usually just say, oh man, sorry about all that. Want a LaCroix? When change is due, your gut knows first, followed by the mouth, then the head. If a relationship is toxic, we will feel it and complain about it long before we know it's over. We will betray ourselves with our words. Our friends will tell us this. Our brains are the last to know. When you know something is not true, it becomes increasingly more difficult to defend it. Whether it's your bad relationship, your ego, your gender identity, or destructive traditions, your head will rage against the dying of the light, because the devil it knows is better than the devil it doesn't. Meanwhile, your gut is prepping the room with balloons and cake, waiting for you to show up to the surprise of peace and good sleep. Each human life is like a winding narrow path through the woods, sometimes moving uphill, sometimes down, sometimes doubling back from a dead end. But our species as a whole moves more like a glacier, carving through the mountains to make a way. The valley we leave will be a natural park someday, visited by tourists as a wonder of the world. In my 20s, I didn't know any married gay couples. I'm sure they were out there, but I didn't know where to find them. I was trying to grow up and be a man and love God and be good. I didn't want to be a scandal. I didn't want to be rejected by the only community I'd ever known. Loving who I wanted to love felt selfish. If being a Christian meant dying to self and serving God, and the Bible said that being gay was wrong, then choosing to follow my heart instead of God was the most selfish thing I could do, I rationalized. In truth, it just felt scary. I didn't want to lose my whole world in search of a kiss. I remember thinking, how come I can't find any committed gay couples who love God? Maybe they don't exist. And if they don't exist, maybe that explains why God warned against it. This line of thinking kept me single my entire 20s, afraid of any kind of romantic love. I needed examples. I wasn't built to go off on my own, spit in the face of my tradition. The saying from Scripture, "The heart is deceitful above all things," swirled in my head. My heart could be lying to me. What a curse. One day, around the age of 27, I was telling all this to a kind and patient mentor of mine. I told him how I didn't have any examples, any lives to model mine after. I figured he'd tell me to trust God and pray to be healed. He didn't. He said, "Jed, it can be hard to tell the difference between an outcast and a pioneer. What if you're meant to be the example you needed? What if God gave you your personality, your unique skill set, to equip you to walk into the wilderness and show that it can be done?" I stared at him while the question expanded in my chest. I hadn't thought of it like that before. And trust me, he continued, those examples are out there, just maybe not in your community. So look hard, read everything, pray, and move in the direction of what's right. God will correct your steps, but you must first start walking. That's what walk in faith means. My mentor didn't say it just like that. It was years ago, and I'm sure my memory has embellished it. But that conversation changed my life. Just because you don't have a roadmap doesn't mean you aren't meant to walk in the direction of your convictions. Look at your gifts, your skills. You may be a pioneer. A friend once said to me, most people are unhappy with their life. They're stuck in a situation that isn't what they hoped for, but they don't see a way out. And they don't see examples of freedom. That is it. We need models. We need examples of a way out. Some of those lone wanderers in the desert are not outcasts. They're pioneers. They became the way out, first for themselves and then for others. This goes for all manners of living, of the job you want, of the community you need, of the project you fear to start. We are waiting for permission, for examples. But what if you are the example? My views on how to feel safe in this world have expanded exponentially. For me, I kept opening doors with trembling hands and fists up, ready for a fight. But the more I've done this and found smiling faces behind the door, the safer I've felt in the endless halls of my constantly changing life. And the wildest thing is, when you think no one is modeling what you need and you dare to step into that for yourself, you will find the room crowded with comrades. With bright eyes and high fives, and you too, it's the best feeling in the world. The feeling of God saying, my love, you thought I was so small. I will never forget sitting on the couch with two of my roommates and asking them, what's an insecurity that you have that I wouldn't know? These are good friends of mine, handsome men in their 20s, loaded down with friends and cool jobs. They said, almost at the same time, I fear that one day I'm going to wake up and realize that my friends have figured me out, that I'm not cool, and they're going to stop talking to me. I think about this every day. In a million tries, I could have never guessed that they would feel this way. And they both did. 10 years after this conversation, one of those friends killed himself. He took his life this past summer. About 5 years ago, he moved away from California and stopped talking to most of us, moved away and cut us out. Those of us left behind would talk about it, shocked and saddened, guessing at his motives, wondering how one of our favorite people could just discard his whole community. Maybe he had become more Christian and considered us backsliders and pagans. Maybe his new friends turned him against us. We didn't know. In the year since he died, I've thought often about his answer to that question, how he wondered if he was faking it and if we would find out, if he thought we were faking it too. He married a beautiful woman and had a child on the way. He was full of laughter and seemed to have a lovely life, and then he ended it. I don't know if his answer to that question all those years ago was a clue to what was coming or just an insecurity that a lot of us share. I don't know if he had a freak moment of brain chemistry, and maybe it had nothing to do with sadness at all. My mind turns it all over, the way we study a tragedy to prevent its repeating. It shows how little we know about one another. Most people walk around with invisible strings, fears about being liked, being enough, marriage, career, vanity, talent, belonging. If you could see the strings pulling at people, you'd be as patient as a pillow with everyone you met. When I see something good in someone, I tell them straight away, like a reflex, even if I don't know them at all. I'm always telling waitresses how beautiful their hair is or how charming they are, or bartenders how masterful they are with the flip of a bottle. This can often be mistaken for flirting. Maybe it is. I love flirting. But I've seen the effects of doing this, and I've felt its effects on me. A kind word can turn a glazed-over stranger into a bright-faced friend. As if they suddenly see themselves in the world, approved by a stranger they had previously ignored. I have found that a compliment from a stranger can reshape my day. And it matters that it is a stranger. If a random kid says he likes my jacket as I walk by, I feel like a fashion genius. If my buddy says it, I'm glad, but not as radiant and giddy as when the compliment comes from someone with no reason to be nice to me. There is something about speaking lovely words to people. Our nervous minds are always trying to see themselves, to fish out the mystery of our standing in the world. Words have all the power. Have you noticed how when someone says, "My first impression of you was," you perk up with wild interest? We want to meet ourselves. This phenomenon works the other way too. In a moment of anger, an emotional pronouncement over someone can poison them for years. You are a disappointment. You are lazy. Saying what someone is like witchcraft. It sticks to you like a spell. The statement may be true in a single moment. You may have been lazy today. But the saying of it can warp your future. "You were lazy today" transforms into "you are lazy." It can act like a curse. For this reason, I tell people what is lovely, so that it becomes more of them. If a talkative friend stops and listens to me, I pause and say, "You're such a good listener." She might lean back and put her hand on her chest and say, "I am?" And then I'll say, "Yes, thank you." She'll be a better listener from that day on. Words have power, to bless or to curse. That's why I love reading them, writing them in cafes, hearing them and saying them. They shape the world. Erik Erikson was the developmental psychologist whose work in the 1950s gave us the term identity crisis. In your teenage years, he said, you enter a crisis of identity versus role confusion. This is the crossroads of discovering your passions, caring about what others think, fitting into a tribe, and maintaining a sense of self. All these feelings collide in high school, and the dust does not often settle until your late 20s. What's wild is that this sense of groping for identity is so common, in spite of how unique and varied each life is. A kid can have married parents, divorced parents, straight parents, or gay parents, be gay, straight, trans, Christian, atheist, rich, poor, and will go through these phases too. Erikson points out that in the case of historical geniuses, the discovering of true identity is often delayed. Toni Morrison's first book was published when she was 39. Miguel de Cervantes wrote Don Quixote in his late 50s. Cézanne had his first solo exhibition at 56. That should give us some comfort. Maybe the reason we don't have our shit together yet is because we're geniuses. There's self-work, and then there's self-obsession. I love personality tests, like the Enneagram. I love how knowing I'm a type 7 tells me something about myself, that at my core, I avoid pain. It's why I'm always traveling and finding new adventures. It's why I jump from pain to laughter, from hurt to cerebral understanding. Why I leave the room when someone is crying. It has helped me understand myself. All this self-excavation is crucial for living a whole, embodied life, for understanding how I work and how I experience the world, how I am in relationships. But I don't want to get lost in it. I've too often reduced people to their Enneagram number. "You're such a 3. That's why you whiten your teeth." I've seen people go to so many retreats, try every new thing, and read every new book. A frantic pattern that only walls the soul deeper behind a mountain of knowledge and lingo, of performative self-understanding. There is a balance. I don't trust someone who isn't interested in their own excavation. But I feel similar about people who overdo it, who are lost in the mirror maze of themselves, whose every act is an act of self-analysis. There is no living in this scenario, only analyzing. I want to be a conscious soul, curious about my makeup. I want to do the important work. But I also acknowledge that I am a strange animal, essentially unknowable to myself. And so are you. An honest wildling who is hungry and eats. A coyote who doesn't know too much for his own good. The image that returns to me most often is the journey of water. It is the most complete metaphor, the most comforting. Water falls as snow on the mountains, as a trillion tiny bits without memory. The love of the sun transforms the snow. They melt and feel one urgency, gravity. They did not learn this. It is just mysteriously ever-present. The stream starts small, a clear trickle. Uncluttered with the confusion of sediment or history, it rolls over rocks and joins with other newborn streams and widens, the beginning of a lifetime of widening. On its way down the mountain, the stream becomes the creek. It collects soil and memories. It flattens a bit. It meets farms and bridges and other confusing things. It joins with other creeks and becomes a river. It is brown now with soil and experience and runoff and living. It runs slower, no longer in a hurry. Muddy with patience, yet always feeling that pull toward somewhere it is certain exists but has never seen. Finally, after a life that started as simply as a clear stream, it pours wide as a mile into the ocean, the endless breadth of eternity. The home it hoped for was real. And the love of the sun is on the ocean. Its heat never stops, and before long, it breaks the water's surface into a trillion little nothings, lifting them like blank souls and sending them back to the mountain. First as rising evaporation, then clouds, then as snow, and we do it all over again. We come from an endlessness wider than the horizon. We are pulled to the sky to begin again, narrow and clear, and make our return. Life is learning to ever widen.